You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Friends and colleagues and distinguished guests, members of the media, whether you're here in person or you're coming in via the webcast, good afternoon and welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is John Allen, and I'm the president here, and we're very pleased to have you with us for our event, which is co-hosted with our colleague institution, the Heritage Foundation, and it is entitled A Strategic Framework for Countering Terrorism and Targeted Violence. As the name suggests, we're hosting today the release of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's new Counterterrorism Strategic Framework, as well as hosting our honored guest, the Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Kevin McAleenan. He'll shortly provide his remarks, which will unveil this effort. Since its creation on 11 September, in the dark and challenging days of 2001, DHS has been a critical platform for combating terrorism in all its horrific forms. Time and again, dedicated servants of the department working hand in hand with their peers throughout the U.S. government and the military have kept America safe from threats both foreign and domestic, and I'm proud to have served alongside many of them over the years as our commitment to national security remains steadfast to this day. The Department of Homeland Security is a bulwark of our freedom and our safety. The threat we're facing, however, has evolved, and adaptation is required. Rising to meet that challenge is the new strategic framework that we'll be discussing today. And ladies and gentlemen, it could not be more timely. All across America, the threat of domestic terrorism grows by the day. With anything from pro-extremist rallies to bomb threats to active shootings becoming common interventions in our media headlines and our daily routines. And this, of course, says nothing of the terrible epidemic of gun violence, which we're experiencing as a nation today. Violence that takes the lives of thousands of innocent Americans each year. What's more, racially and ethnically motivated violence, in particular that inspired by white supremacists, the sources of which of this violence are antithetical to our shared and cherished values, this scourge is also on the rise. This reality has driven a wedge into already strained political, socioeconomic, racial, ethnic, and religious divides and has made our nation less fundamentally safe, less prosperous, and ultimately less free. The threat is clear, and it is real. And thankfully, finding ways to combat all forms of terrorism and targeted violence is central to why we're gathered here today. This strategic framework, on which the Secretary will comment briefly, is a product of the tireless work of DHS's colleagues and often was the result of consulting with a variety of outside experts as well to develop and hone the details. And some of those experts were our very own from Brookings and the Heritage Foundation. It's a serious document with serious goals and objectives and actions and well worth our time to read and to consider in detail. But let me also be clear in saying that it took vision to conceptualize and to develop this document. And I commend the department, and in particular, the acting secretary, for taking a stand on these issues, which grow with seriousness, in seriousness, every single day. So we've got a lot to do this afternoon. The acting secretary will soon come to the stage and provide some remarks about the framework. And once he's concluded, I'll join him for a very brief one-on-one conversation here on the stage. And to help facilitate your questions following the Secretary's remarks, we'll be passing out note cards, which our staff will collect and will produce for me on the stage. It's a very short timeline, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to recognize that our ability to take questions from the audience may be constrained by that timeline. As you fill out the cards, I'd ask you to put the name and the organization on the top, and a question as opposed to something else, and please write legibly. Once we've concluded, the acting secretary will depart, and then we'll transition to a featured panel of very distinguished experts Susan Hennessy, our senior fellow at Brookings and executive editor of the Lawfare, will moderate the panel. Jim Carafano, who is vice president and E.W. Richardson fellow of the Heritage Foundation, will be joining us. Seamus Hughes, the deputy director of the program of extremism at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. George Salim, senior vice president of programs of the Anti-Defamation League. And Chad Wolf, the senior official performing the duties of the Undersecretary and Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security for Strategy, Plans, Analysis, and Risk. It is quite a lineup, and they're going to discuss amongst themselves with Susan moderating for about 45 minutes using the same note card system as I described before. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Acting Secretary McAleenan to the stage.
Thank you, General Allen, and thank you so much to Brookings and Heritage for hosting us today. I really appreciate Dr. Carafano, your participation in the event as well. It's an honor to be among such an impressive group of academics, public servants, and experts to lay out the Department of Homeland Security's new strategic framework for countering the evolving terrorism and targeted violence threats that we face today. Our department was created in the wake of the devastating 9/11 attacks, charged with coordinating and unifying the nation's homeland security efforts. And our mission is multidimensional, built on the five pillars of prevention, protection, mitigation, response, and recovery. The origin story of the department is a key element of our nation's response to the September 11th attacks, and our founding was intended to improve the ability to defend against foreign terrorist organizations seeking to harm the American people. The Al-Qaeda organization, first and foremost, loomed for years after the 9/11 attacks as the homeland's most significant terrorism concern. Then, as now, our first priority was and is to defend the country against terrorism, to ensure that no terrorist has access to the homeland or can exploit our trade, travel, or immigration systems. This is the Department of Homeland Security's core charge. And as President Bush put it at the National Cathedral just 3 days after 9/11, the commitment of our fathers is now the calling of our time. I put that quote above my cubicle in November 2001 in the nascent Office of Anti-Terrorism in the former U.S. Customs Service as a reminder of our purpose while we worked to advance a compelling and new priority mission. It is a DHS calling that has been heeded by thousands and a mission that has been maintained with success for nearly two decades. It is who we are. As a department, we are aware that the threats to the homeland continue to evolve. Today, they have evolved beyond those foreign terrorist organizations to include emerging challenges with domestic terrorism and targeted violence here at home. Targeted violence refers to any incident of violence that implicates homeland security in which an attacker selects a particular target prior to the violent attack. We continue to see violent acts inspired by hateful ideologies across our nation. On April 27th of this year, a gunman opened fire at the Shabbat of Poway Synagogue in Poway, California, killing one and injuring three others. The anti-Semitism that motivated him was ignorant and cowardly, and this attack was just one in a string of acts of targeted violence our nation has recently seen. That was my third week as acting secretary, and the department mobilized quickly to respond. We had recently commissioned the Office of Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention to galvanize and integrate our diverse efforts to secure the nation and to help prepare communities all across the country, building off previous department efforts to address all forms of targeted violence that threaten our homeland, regardless of the ideologies or lack thereof animating them. As this office began coordinating prevention efforts across our broad department, it became apparent that we had more work to do. Given the events globally in Christchurch, New Zealand, and closer to home at the gathering of multiple congregations at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, as well as the burnings of African-American churches in Louisiana in March and April, I requested a new subcommittee of our Homeland Security Advisory Council, co-chaired by General Allen and Paul Goldenberg, to explore how we could improve our efforts to secure faith-based organizations against targeted violence and domestic terrorism. And we began developing a strategic framework that would build on our success in the struggle against foreign terrorist organizations and incorporate lessons learned from those successes to develop an approach to address the evolving threats of today. As we are in the middle of these efforts, our nation was struck again, this time twice in the same weekend in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. With over 4,000 DHS professionals, agents and officers and their families living in El Paso, this attack hit very close to home for us. Six family members of DHS employees were killed. and one DHS professional was shopping in the Walmart at the time of the attack, and due to her training, was able to render life-saving aid to one of the victims. That attacker sought to kill Hispanics, and his online manifesto was rife with references to multiple hate-based ideologies. The majority of our El Paso team, working to protect our nation, uphold the rule of law, and care for vulnerable migrants arriving at our border, is Hispanic. These professionals are American patriots who work every day to protect what our nation of immigrants is all about. So we stood together alongside leaders from El Paso, the state of Texas, and Mexico, and addressed this attack with moral clarity. We said it was hate. We said it was domestic terrorism, that it had no place in our society, and it reinforced our confidence in the focus of our strategy we have been developing for several months. As the president put it, in one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Our department recognizes clearly and unambiguously that today's terrorism and targeted violence threats stem both from enemies, foreign and domestic, or multiple ideologies, or in some cases, none at all. Some of the most serious threats we continue to confront today have been part of the department's focus since its inception, like the ongoing threat from forced terrorist organizations. In coordination with our partners at the Department of Defense and across the intelligence community, the Department of Homeland Security has defended against the foreign terrorist threat for nearly two decades. We have developed sophisticated methods to target this threat, including a defense-in-depth approach to our homeland security. This posture pushes our borders outward, extends our zone of security, and ensures that we are aware of the movement of illicit actors long before they attempt to enter the United States. And as a result, we've been very successful at denying terrorists entry to the U.S. or through our travel systems. Today, the large majority of our encounters with foreign known or suspected terrorists occur well beyond our borders, and we coordinate with international partners to take operational actions. But foreign terrorist organizations and radical Islamic terrorists continue to plot against the United States. Continued vigilance and enhancement of our department's efforts to thwart them is crucial. ISIS and Al-Qaeda remain the two most pressing radical Islamic terrorist threats to the homeland through their potential to direct plots and also to inspire homegrown violent extremism in their name. Homegrown violent extremists have conducted 8 lethal terrorist attacks in the United States since 2014, claiming 83 lives. One demographic from the conflict in Syria and Iraq represents a critical concern for the United States and much of the world, foreign fighters. The Syria conflict attracted some 40,000 individuals from foreign countries as combatants. While many died on the battlefield, thousands have left the region, returning to their home countries or often going to remote parts of the world where they can more easily plan or facilitate continued terrorist attacks. As the primary federal agency responsible for travel intelligence against all threats, it is critical that the department understand who these actors are, prevent them from entering the United States and our partner nations, and protect our trade and immigration systems from their exploitation. We will continue to extend our reach beyond U.S. borders to detect these threats, improve our vetting capabilities, and to disrupt any illicit trade activity that funds terrorism, and improve and adapt our screening capabilities, among other efforts. However, the overall terrorism and targeted violence threat has evolved. Not only do we face serious threats from a greater number of disparate actors than at any time since 9/11, but we also see these actors exploiting modern communications and emerging technologies, including, for example, everything from social media to hacking activity to unmanned aircraft systems, to facilitate, plan, and execute their attacks. Domestically, as we have seen in the attacks in Poway, El Paso, Pittsburgh, Charleston, and elsewhere, there is evidence of this growing number of threat actors who seek to attack the seams of our diverse and vibrant social fabric and incite our nation's most vulnerable populations, our youth, are disenfranchised and disaffected to violence against their fellow citizens. These individuals are motivated by various violent extremist ideologies, including those that can be described as racial, ethnic, anti-government, or anti-authority in orientation, including, very concerningly and increasingly, white supremacist violent extremism. Attackers often plan and carry out their acts of violence alone and with little apparent warning in ways that limit the effectiveness of traditional law enforcement investigation and disruption methods. Today, white supremacist extremism is one of the most potent ideologies driving acts of targeted violence in this country. The FBI has highlighted a 40% growth in these investigations. White supremacist violent extremism's outlook can generally be characterized by hatred for immigrants and ethnic minorities, with a historic focus on the African American community. I would like to take this opportunity to be direct and unambiguous in addressing this major issue of our time. In our modern age, the continued menace of racially based violent extremism particularly white supremacist extremism, is an abhorrent affront to our nation, the struggle and unity of its diverse population, and the core values of both our society and our department. It has no place in the United States of America, and as the President has called us to do, we will work to defeat it. In this evolving threat environment, our department must double down on the successes of our traditional counterterrorism efforts, powered by our unique authorities and operations in the international and border environments, while simultaneously expanding our focus to provide a coordinated approach in the prevention of terrorism and targeted violence originating within our borders by extremists of all ideologies, and empowering whole-of-community efforts across the country. While the challenges facing our nation are great, the Department will continue to operate with clear eyes and urgency on the threats we face. As Acting Secretary, I consider it our duty and a moral imperative for the dedicated and talented workforce of the Department to help lead this effort. That is why today I'm pleased to announce the release of the Department of Homeland Security Strategic Framework for Countering Terrorism and Targeted Violence, representing our vision and commitment to the American people to address the evolving terrorist and targeted violence threats. Rather than starting from whole cloth, this strategic framework acknowledges the Department's successes in the counterterrorism fight across intelligence, targeting, investigations, and operations, and seeks to apply many of these tools our Department has developed over the years to counter foreign threats and the lessons learned from those experiences to counter emerging threats within our borders. We will do this in a transparent manner to hold ourselves accountable to the American people and maintain our commitment to respect critically important privacy and civil liberties protections that are ensconced both in our Constitution and in the Department of Homeland Security's core values. Designed to amplify and execute the Trump administration's 2018 National Strategy for Counterterrorism, the first strategy for counterterrorism in this nation to mention domestic terrorism, the strategic framework has four key goals: understand the evolving terrorism and targeted violence threat environment and support partners in the Homeland Security enterprise through that specialized knowledge; prevent terrorists and other hostile actors from entering the United States and deny them the opportunity to exploit the nation's trade, immigration, and domestic and international travel systems; prevent terrorism and targeted violence here at home; and enhance U.S. infrastructure protections and community preparedness. We will not become complacent in protecting the homeland from the foreign terrorist threat through this strategy. However, the vast and diverse skill sets within the department allow us to employ a counterterrorism strategic framework that targets foreign and domestic actors with some of the same effective and flexible tools in concert with Americans' privacy and civil rights expectations and commitments. While driving forward in addressing the foreign terrorist threat, building on our foundation, we are also turning our attention to the growing and emerging threats within our borders. And first and foremost, that means that the department's new strategic framework aggressively targets the threat of targeted violence in the United States. As we know well, these attacks have a broad impact on American citizens and our national climate. Not only do they take innocent lives, but they diminish citizens' perception of safety in communities and public spaces. These attacks pull at the civic seams of our diverse country, which is why enemies, foreign and domestic, seek to incite this type of violence within our borders. While other departments and agencies have separate and vital roles to play, this framework amplifies the lines of effort specific to the Department of Homeland Security in the domestic terrorism realm, which are prevention and protection. The Trump administration's National Strategy for Counterterrorism calls on the U.S. government to champion and institutionalize prevention and create a global prevention architecture with the help of civil society, private partners, and the technology industry. The Department of Homeland Security will do just that, pursuing a whole-of-community approach to prevention as the best way to protect at-risk individuals without infringing upon cherished civil liberties. Individuals, families, private and nonprofit groups, faith-based organizations, and state, local, territorial, and tribal organizations are often in the best position to prevent an individual's mobilization to violence. In the strategic framework, our prevention efforts focus on empowering partners in state and local government, as well as the private sector, to enhance the security of citizens here at home. This approach serves as a powerful example of DHS's role as a communicator, coordinator, and enabler, responding to the national-level crises across multiple jurisdictions and entities. To empower our state and local partners, we will enhance and expand our capabilities across the department to help ensure that they have the resources, personnel, training, and other assistance needed to intervene before an individual commits violent acts. These efforts, to be coordinated by our Office of Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention, but driven by our components in the field, include training community stakeholders, conducting threat and vulnerability assessments, active shooter exercises, partnering with state and local governments and nonprofit organizations to inform common risk factors to help prevent mobilization to violence and find those off-ramps and intervention opportunities, and sending department personnel to the field to assist state and local governments in establishing their own prevention programs. Second, we will provide them with the latest understanding of the threat from terrorism and targeted violence. The strategic framework introduces an annual State of the Homeland Threat Assessment that will provide current analysis and data on the state of the threat that the homeland confronts, helping to inform all levels of government and the broader public. In addition, the U.S. Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center, or NTAC, plays a leading role in behavioral analysis and trainings, spreading threat assessment models as they've been doing for more than two decades to stakeholders across the country, helping to identify individuals who may be mobilizing to violence. In their latest analytic report, Mass Attacks in Public Spaces, NTAC found that the vast majority of cases of mass attacks and targeted violence studied in 2018, families, friends, or bystanders had raised concerns about violent actors prior to them committing violence, providing an opportunity for intervention if we take a whole-of-community effort and provide the tools to state and locals that they need. We will also counter terrorist and violent extremist influence online by engaging our partners in the private sector. The private sector plays a very significant role in social resilience and has the ability to inform the public of the risks associated with the spread of violent extremist ideology. We will continue to support the efforts by tech companies, NGOs, and community partners to spread counter-messaging campaigns seeking to steer individuals away from messages of violence. It is clear to us that we must institutionalize and scale our prevention efforts because intervention can and will prevent tragedies. But because not all attacks can be prevented, we must simultaneously work to build our resilience and our ability to respond and recover when they do occur. Our nation's infrastructure and public spaces are high-value targets for terrorism and targeted violence, and we consider it a department responsibility to spread awareness across the threat environment, the private sector, and the public. Fortifying our communities against targeted attacks is within our control, and we are well-positioned to promote preparedness in our partners. The department has a small protection mission handled by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which leads federal government efforts to mitigate the nation's infrastructure and prevent vulnerabilities. CISA's Soft Target and Crowded Spaces Guide provides tools, resources, and training to key stakeholders to help prepare for and respond to active shooter events. Since the program's inception in 2011, there have been more than 300 workshops with nearly 40,000 participants and 930,000 successful completions of online training. It's imperative that we increase the number of communities prepared to perform their role in preventing and protecting against, mitigating or responding to, and recovering from these attacks. Preparedness is a shared responsibility, and we are calling for everyone's involvement, not just the government. Recent studies and lessons learned from our foreign partners show us that prevention protection rule tools work, and the first national-level strategic framework to apply these tools to both terrorism and targeted violence simultaneously is what we're offering today. As this strategic framework explicitly states, terrorism and targeted violence overlap as problems and therefore require a shared set of solutions. DHS is introducing new methods of creating a more comprehensive understanding of the challenge of terrorism and targeted violence both within and outside the federal government. Importantly, it explicitly recognizes the need to focus and protect our most vulnerable populations, particularly our youth. And as our department is always forward-looking, the strategic framework is designed to assess DHS's past and provide a guidepost to its future. It intentionally focuses on how emerging technology can exacerbate these threats, but also how technology can help provide solutions to counter them. The strategic framework is our formal recognition of the emerging threat of targeted violence in the United States. It makes clear that our whole of department is committed to addressing that threat, just as we are committed to addressing the threat posed by foreign terrorist organizations. At the same time, we intend for this framework to articulate a vision for how our nation will respond to the evolving threats we face. Our department has dedicated operators and personnel, some of whom in the audience, who will play a critical role in implementing the strategic framework with vigilance and integrity. But we will only be successful with an extensive whole-of-government approach and collaboration, dedicated resourcing from Congress, and the commitment of the American public. DHS will follow our strategic framework with a public action plan, explaining to the American people in greater detail how we intend to accomplish our goals. So I'll close with this. I've been with the Department of Homeland Security since its inception, joining a predecessor agency after 9/11. I have participated directly in the development of our efforts to prevent terrorists from accessing the homeland, along with U.S. Customs and Border Protection and interagency colleagues, and I'm well acquainted with the foreign terrorist threats to our homeland. At the same time, I have watched this threat evolve to what it is today, with targeted violence and domestic terrorism, unfortunately, taking increasing prominence. That's why I'm convinced that this expanded and balanced approach is necessary. We at DHS have committed our resources to addressing this threat. That time is now to take additional steps, and there's already significant work underway. We look forward to collaboration and feedback from diverse stakeholders, including our outstanding panel, which you'll hear from shortly, to enhance our action and implementation. And I thank you for your time and attention today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
All right.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're on a short timeline, so let me quickly ask the first question, and then we'll get some up from the audience. Very comprehensive layout on the strategic framework, and I think many folks here have heard of parts of this, but I don't know that they've ever heard of it all together.
Right.
So what's new? To recap, why the need for the strategic framework, and what's new in this framework ultimately that's to the benefit of the country?
Well, I think it's very clear, given the types of attacks we're facing, the public response, the concern nationally, that we need to do something compelling and urgent and very clear. Coming from CBP and seeing how we could work, even though most of our actions were operational and directly coordinated, we could work through industry to do things like secure the global supply chain, to help enhance security standards, to inform, to provide threat assessments and provide guidance on steps that could be taken. Looking across the department, understanding what CISA is doing, Secret Service, FEMA, Federal Protective Service, we have all these capabilities reaching out to communities around the country. We need to coordinate, integrate, and galvanize that effort and make sure that everyone understands the tools, resources available, and is focused on this problem, focused on getting in front of it and preventing pathways to violence, but also being prepared to respond effectively.
Mr. Secretary, how do you feel, or how have you sensed the willingness of the private sector to step up, to be a partner with you in this? This is a critical issue.
Yeah, I think they're very willing, and we're seeing the same thing from state and local communities, non-governmental organizations. As you know from your faith-based work on the Homeland Security Advisory Task Force, there's a lot of ownership and willingness to partner. What they need is the tools. What threats are they facing? What are the best practices to be ready for potential act of targeted violence? You know, everything from, you know, evacuation plans to understanding how to help a young person find a pathway off that route to violence.
Sure.
I mean, those are the kind of things that we're seeing, a wide open partnership. Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center, in their mass attacks in public spaces, they've done training for 12,000 people this calendar year alone. Mm. Mental health professionals, school resource officers, state and local government, that's the kind of engagement we're getting. We want to make sure we're wielding that without overlap and prioritizing on risk and making sure everyone knows the resources are available.
A similar question on social media platforms.
Right.
Those are very powerful, and they can work to our advantage. They can really work to our detriment. How are you finding that challenge?
Yeah, so there's lots of thorny challenges that the strategy does not fully solve. And one of those is the conversation we have to have on the issues in the conversation online that is unfortunately helping accelerate a pathway to violence. It's providing individuals that might be disaffected or angry with validation, with the community around their feelings. We have to understand, without policing ideology or affecting speech, how we see that risk and how we can intervene as a community in advance.
And that's the issue of balancing free speech, privacy, against the hate that can be promulgated and ultimately penetrate into
exactly.
Society on these social platforms.
Right.
Mr. Secretary, where would you like to see, given this framework and the work of the department, the partnerships that you are creating, where do you want to see us in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months as a result of what's just happened today?
Sure. Well, we've developed an immediate surge action plan, which I did not cover because then it would have been a very long set of remarks. It was already long. But we're going to implement that immediately. But beyond that, we are developing an action plan that's going to provide that roadmap with specificity on the interagency partnerships, on our expectations for the DHS components and their outreach to the whole of community efforts. But it's also going to probably result in some resource implications. We have asked for an out-of-cycle budget increase to support the Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention Office and that build-out, as well as some additional grants for prevention of violence out in the field. But we think we're probably going to need more to fully realize this effort. But we do have a tremendous amount of capability, resources, and dedicated experts already on staff and providing this guidepost and how we want them to approach their mission. We think we're going to see immediate impact.
That's terrific. And I'll ask for the cards now, if I could, please. very much. I think it's Tom Warnke of the Atlanta Council. Thank you for the question. The question calls for more efforts and programs to make it succeed. Do you know how much more this strategy framework will cost? And has the White House and Congress given you, the DHS, what you think will be the resources today and given you an indication of the willingness to give you the resources in the future?
Right. I may have just pre-answered that question on my last response. But the president, after El Paso, called for resource needs for the FBI, for other domestic terrorism efforts across the interagency. And so we're assessing that right now. We'll be talking with the professionals at OMB and seeing what we need from Congress to further support that effort. But again, with the Targeted Violence for Terrorism Prevention Office, with the efforts across DHS, from CISA to Secret Service to FPS, FEMA, our Intelligence and Analysis Shop, and our operating components, we think we can make an impact right away.
You mentioned perceptions of safety. And, of course, the department in last mass shootings has paid a personal price for this. How do you think Americans view in their current perception of safety? Is it a misperception or a perception that the department can help to inform with respect to how safe our population is?
And that's a good question. I mean, we see two things. We don't want people to be complacent that something can't happen here. We also don't want people to be scared to go outside. And so what I think, and the president after El Paso, he said, we cannot afford to be hopeless. We can't afford to sit pat on our laurels. We have to take action. And what we're trying to do, from really across the department, is empower citizens to be resilient, to understand risk factors, to be able to identify them, to know how to respond, right? There's not all interventions are not created equal.
That's right.
Some require a law enforcement intervention. Some are more of a conversation. Some are a mental health or a family support effort that's required. So we want to provide people the awareness and the tools, really, in that whole of community effort. I mean, it's consistent across our counterterrorism mission, targeted violence, but it's also what we're trying to do with cyber and on foreign influence. And there is an important statement on resilience against foreign influence in this strategy as well.
I want to thank you for the very clear public statement on white supremacists, white supremacy, its hateful ideology. That is something all Americans need to hear about all the time, because we're all victims of it,
right?
Regardless of our origins. We're all victims of it, and I want to thank you for that. And the more our country commits to that, the safer we will be in the end. You talked about, in the context of foreign influence and foreign terrorism, that the department has pushed its borders out. The country has pushed
right.
its borders out. Could you talk to us a little bit about the partnerships that you see overseas? What form does that take? I don't know necessarily that America is well informed on that. We're safe,
right,
in many respects because of that. What does that really mean?
Sure. I mean, that's been really a multi-decade effort across the interagency. UN Security Council supports continued improvement in this area with the Resolution 2396. But DHS and really CBP has been at the forefront of creating this capacity internationally. These are things like creating the ability to create a watch list, to analyze passenger manifests, to identify known threats, to collect biometrics and create these interdictions, and really have a shared visibility of potential movement of security or threat actors and be able to coordinate on operational action. So it's something that we've been working closely with the Europeans for years. They've taken a number of significant steps both in their law and in their operationalization of it over the last 5 years. We have a very good network in the Western Hemisphere working on identifying threats heading toward our border, especially from outside the hemisphere, and we're going to continue to build on that capacity. It's called for explicitly in the strategy. Again, this is not a shift of DHS focus entirely. It's a balancing of DHS focus and really trying to build on the outstanding capabilities, techniques, and international partnerships we've already developed.
And those are essential. They really do keep the border distant from our shores. That's really important.
One more
question. The report does identify multiple threats, but what will DHS actually do to prevent white nationalism and disinformation campaigns that support it? Are you forming any task forces or specific organizations within the context of your ability to answer that, that will be focused on that that threat and that challenge?
Right. So a couple different answers. First, I want to emphasize Department of Justice and the FBI remain the primary investigative entity for domestic terrorism. DHS supports them extensively as the largest provider of agents and intel analysts to the Joint Terrorism Task Forces all around the country. So that, I think that's the first part of that answer. But specifically, and again, the action plan is going to lay all of this out. What steps are we going to take? One is the engagement with the private sector. Again, not policing ideology,
right.
But the private sector has the ability, as Cloudflare did in the immediate aftermath of the El Paso attack, to make a decision to not support a website that's become a cesspool of hate. For instance, that's the kind of decision making we want to see out there in the private sector. The task force that you're working on, how do we prevent and protect violence against faith-based organizations and houses of worship? That has a direct correlation with getting out in front of a white supremacist extremist attack. So we're going to take a lot of specific steps through this strategy. One I want to highlight in particular is the State of the Homeland Threat Assessment. Our Intelligence Analysis Directorate has dramatically increased their reporting on domestic terrorism, 150% increase last year, and a lot of those finished intelligence and tactical reports have involved white supremacist extremism. So we're pushing that out through our fusion centers all around the country. We have liaisons in sheriff's offices and police departments, and we're trying to get that information out that can help aid state and local law enforcement to take effective action. Again, that's where DHS is not the operational entity, but we can support it. One last point.
Sure.
If we see white supremacist extremist connections with international organizations, say in Europe or elsewhere, we already have ongoing investigations and National Targeting Center interdiction efforts to prevent that collaboration and correlation internationally.
Terrific. So with the deployment of the framework today, are there one or two real seams or gaps in how we are postured today to protect our citizens that you'd like to see be closed by this?
Yeah, I do think that conversation on the online aspect is really important. And it's not one that DHS is going to own alone. That's a whole of society conversation or congressional engagement. But, you know, it's become too easy to get validation for your ideology, even if your ideology is shifting, and we are seeing that. The other concern that it provides is really an acceleration. The velocity of cases the FBI talks about have increased dramatically from inspiration to action. We want to make sure that we're thinking through how to get in front of that.
And one final question. I know your time is very tight. You did talk about the six family members who were killed in the shootings and the one family member who was able to make a difference at a critical moment.
Yeah.
This is an easy question, I think, but I think Americans need to hear this as well, and that is, tell us about the people that are part of your department. And I see a TSA, Transportation Security Administration officer out in the audience. I see a Coast Guard officer out in the audience. It's a diverse organization of really dedicated people. Can you tell us a little bit about who's in this department, please?
Sure. Yeah, and I would name them, but they prefer their anonymity because I see some folks out in the audience who, you know, outside of maybe Troy Miller, our director of field operations in New York, have done more than any other people in DHS to address the foreign terrorist threat and prevent its access to the United States. But, you know, the professionals we have at the Department of Homeland Security are a daily source of inspiration. They're incredible. I was out with them on Laredo, Texas, and San Diego, California earlier this week. You know, completely different operational areas, but seeing how they're making improvements to our border security. You know, we talked with one. I'll give you one more example. David Higgerson, I'll name him. He is a Laredo DFO. He's finishing his 49th year in federal service. He's going to be retiring in about 6 weeks. And what he wanted to talk about was the progress over the last 5 years and then the things that he was, you know, frustrated to have to leave unfinished. For instance, we're trying to build a port of the future where a truck never has to slow down as it crosses the border. It can be scanned in motion. It can be targeted for risk, both the driver, the cargo, in an integrated fashion. And he wanted to see that realized, but he's not going to get that done before October 31st. But we have a lot of professionals who will maintain that effort. So it's a tremendous group of people that continue to work every day to secure our country, and it's an honor to work alongside them.
Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for deploying this important framework. We look forward to being a platform to help you continue to improve it as time goes on, along with our partnership with Heritage. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, General. Secretary. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much. All right.
Starting now, we ask you to stay in your seats as we reload the.
In the interest of time, I will get started while my fellow panelists are being mic'd up. So thank you to General Allen and to Secretary McAleenan for the important discussion we just heard. I'm Susan Hennessy. I'm a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution and the executive editor of Lawfare. And I will be moderating this panel today. Before I introduce our panelists, we'll remind everybody that we're doing the same note card procedure. So please just, if you have any notes for the panel, write down your name, your affiliation, your question, and who it's directed to, and just pass it to the end. Somebody from Brookings will collect it, and we will address all of those at the end. And I'll give a brief reminder whenever we have sort of last call for questions. I will briefly introduce my fellow panelists now. You all have their very impressive and very long biographies in your printed material, so I will give a very brief snapshot of those biographies. So next to me is Chad Wolf, who's the senior official performing the duties of the Undersecretary and the Assistant Secretary for Strategy, Plans, Analysis, and Risk in the Office of Strategy, Policy, and Planning at the Department of Homeland Security. He's been with the Department of Homeland Security since 2007. Seamus Hughes is the Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He previously worked at the National Counterterrorism Center and was the Senior Counterterrorism Advisor for the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Past him is James Carafano, the Vice President at the Heritage Foundation's Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy and the E.W. Richardson Fellow. And past him is George Salim, the Vice President, Senior Vice President of Programs at the Anti-Defamation League. He previously served as DHS's first Director of the Office for Community Partnerships and has served in the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations. So thank you all for being here today. To get things started, I will ask Undersecretary Wolf to share some prepared remarks as sort of his reflections on the strategy.
Let me first by thanking both Brookings and Heritage for hosting the event today. As well as my panelists. I get the privilege to talk up here, but I want to acknowledge all my fellow DHS folks that are in the audience. They are the ones that are doing this work, so I get to talk about it, but they actually do it. So it's a tremendous asset that they are here today. I'll touch on three points that sort of people have asked me over the last several weeks as we talk to folks about the strategic framework. What are the takeaways? What do you take away from this? So, three points which the acting secretary hit on, but I think is important to sort of underscore. One is the evolving nature of the threat. So we've been focused as a department since the inception on international terrorism, on foreign terrorist organizations and the like, and how do we stop individuals from exploiting our trade, travel, and immigration systems. What we're seeing now is a change and a focus. We're starting to see a troubling rise in domestic terrorism-related events. And so what that requires is the department to shift its focus and its priorities as well. So that's sort of point number one. Point number two would be the targeted violence that the acting secretary talked about. I think that's an important point. A lot of our stakeholders are still very concerned about your traditional terrorism-related events, but they are also growing extremely concerned about our soft target attacks, mass shootings, whether they're at stadiums, nightclubs, schools, and perhaps those attacks aren't tied to any one ideology, but they're concerning nevertheless. And what are the tools and resources that our local communities need to protect themselves? So that's point number two. Point number three would be our prevention mission as a department. I don't think that's one that's well understood. I think most folks understand what the department does from an aviation security standpoint, from a targeting standpoint, as folks come into the country, maritime cargo, air cargo come in. sort of our traditional bread and butter counterterrorism efforts, but where we're what's called out in the strategic framework and what I think is different than in years past and what the acting secretary has really elevated is in the prevention space. And whether we talk about a whole of society or a whole of community approach, as well as working with our social media and internet providers, that's really the sort of the difference maker here. So those are the three big buckets I believe the acting secretary touched on. I would underscore each of those. And that's really what stands out in my mind with this strategic framework as versus others in the past.
So this is a really dense document, and I think we could have probably five different discussions for an hour about any one element of it. So to sort of kick us off, I'd like to ask each of the panelists to sort of share. You've had time to review this document and think about it a little bit. And so to ask each of you to share sort of what is your big takeaway? What did you, reading this, what was your sort of overriding reaction of what's important here? And George, maybe I'll start with you, and we can move inward from there.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you to all those at Brookings and Heritage for hosting this great event today and for the department to facilitating this really collaborative engagement on such an important topic. So three quick points. The first is that I greatly appreciate both the document and the secretary specifically pointing out the fact that over the past decade, more American lives, murders and homicides in the United States, lives have been lost at the hands of domestic terrorists, individuals in this country, than have at the hands of foreign-inspired terrorist organizations. And that's such an important point that's both rooted in this document on page 8 and the secretary spoke to explicitly. Second, the document points out, and as the secretary mentioned also, the annual Homeland Security Threat Assessment. I think this is something that many advocacy organizations, scholars, think tanks, and American citizens find to be reassuring in the sense that the department is going to take stock for the nature of risk and threat across the country from a whole range of sources, not just from foreign terrorist organizations. And I think this is really an important element that has been one of the key missing nodes in our Homeland Security apparatus for some time. And third is the dynamic that the strategy calls out for community resilience and community partnerships. I mean, this is such an important statistic. As we know, in 2017, calendar year, we saw a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents across the United States. Calendar year 2018 was the third highest year of anti-Semitic incidents across the country, and that's coupled with the Department of Justice and FBI's own data that shows a 17% increase in hate crime across the board, affecting all ethnic, religious, minority communities and protected classes in this country. So the state of homeland security is one that many communities across this country, Jewish, Muslim, Latinx, LGBTQ, and others, do not feel safe in their own homes. So as we start to think about implementing this framework of homeland security, it's critical to acknowledge the fear and anxiety that many communities feel when they pray at their house of worship or that they gather in their community centers across the country. And I think the acknowledgement of that in this strategy is an important element to start repairing much of the damage that has been inflicted on those communities in recent years.
Yeah, I think we absolutely disagree. I take a totally different interpretation of what's going on. First thing I want to say is thank you for Brookings for co-hosting the event with the Heritage Foundation. And I did want to say, Chad, the reason we did a report with CSIS, which was the first ones to recommend that we have an undersecretary for policy, so you're welcome. I don't think it actually reflects an evolution of the threat. The threat's changing. Threats always change. We could have a discussion on that. Be happy to do that. But what I do think it does is it reflects an evolution of the department and one which arguably is constructive. And the reason for that is if you actually look at the functional elements of the department and you look at the statutory mission of the department, it was designed, and Homeland Security's main mission is to really deal with a transnational terrorist threat. And its instruments, its capabilities, its authorities are really designed to do that, and that's what it primarily does. And the reason why the transnational numbers are so low is because they're actually doing a pretty good job. Even if you look at domestically where there are groups with transnational links, the value of DHS really is in that international role. So probably the most memorable is the Times Square bomber, that even though he was acted domestically, he was caught because of DHS, because they flagged him as he tried to leave the country. Now, that doesn't mean there is no role for the Department of Homeland Security in dealing with domestic terrorism and its related cousin targeted violence. And I think the very strong analogy, the appropriate analogy, is the way we address disaster response. We have what's called in the United States all-hazard response, right? When there's a big disaster, FEMA shows up. And we had this big debate about whether FEMA should be in the department or not, because not everything that FEMA responds to is Homeland Security. So why isn't the Homeland Security Department? So some smart guy, which is remarkable that somebody in the Congress could be smart, said, look, when there's a disaster, we can't sit around and wait and say, okay, we got to figure out if this is another 9/11 or if this is a gasoline. You know, we've got to respond and save lives, because that's the mission of public safety, and we'll sort the rest out later. So in only senses, we have one national disaster response system. And I think that's the right analogy for DHS. Although DHS is not really a domestic security agency, and dealing with domestic terrorism is not really a DHS job, they have capabilities and instruments that are useful in helping and supporting that, because they're there for the baseline mission of the department. And similarly with targeted violence, we're not going to sit around when there's a mass shooting to say, okay, you know, was he a crazy nut job, or is he a left-wing terrorist or a right-wing terrorist? We're going to respond. And I think what the document reflects is and appropriately, and what we should focus on, is the efficient use of DHS resources in support of public safety missions, because the real executors here are the state and local government. What DHS is really doing is applying support to the state and local governments, which really have that role. I just want to say one other thing just real quickly, which is, you know, talk about the elephant in the room that we don't talk about. The problem with this issue and dealing with what's the appropriate public safety response is it's overlaid by a massive political debate. Right. And let's be honest. Everybody wants to politicize this issue, whether it's gun control, or we hate white supremacists and let's connect them to Republicans, or we hate left-wing politicians, so let's connect them with Antifa or whatever. And that, I think, is if we try to analyze what the department is and should be doing through our political agendas, which people are wont to do, it does a great disservice to the instrument. And in turn, if the instrument tries to be tuned and tuning itself to account for what people politically want to do, we're not going to do good public safety. And so I applaud one key finding, which is we're not running around battling ideologies here, right? Which is not the department's mission. We're running around and we're operating in the public safety space, which is responding to acts, preventing acts. And I think that very clear line which we deal with, where there is the precursor of a crime, right? Where there's a clear logic intent to a crime that requires an intervention, where you're providing resources and capabilities to jump in. And I think that's the sweet spot the department really needs to stay in. Thank
you. I'm going to be relatively short, because I think the question and answer is going to lead to some interesting conversations. First of all, I want to commend DHS for a very broad and far-reaching comprehensive report and strategy. I think it covers a whole host of issues, and that's, you know, speaking to the mission that is DHS. My big takeaway of looking at this 30 pages was it's a radical shift. And in many ways, you saw kind of the holdover from the Obama administration in terms of efforts. But the inclusion of targeted violence is going to change the way the Department of Homeland Security operates. And I don't think we fully kind of get that. In fact, the strategy calls for definitions for targeted violence, but you're going to have to get the FBI and NCTC with their own authorities to sign on to that idea and look at that. That also means that the way you approach those issues can be radically different too. So if you're talking about terrorism prevention or countering violent extremism, you know, we talk a lot about community resiliency, but the way you approach countering violent extremism for targeted violence is radically different than the way you would approach it for, say, jihadist-inspired terrorism. It's also radically different when you talk about domestic terrorism, right? You're not doing a round table with sovereign citizens telling them, you know, how wrong they are, right? And so they're going to have to shift the way they approach this in many ways. I do want to commend the department for the announcement of the annual Homeland Security Threat Assessment. I think that'll be helpful not only for academics but the public to get a full sense of, you know, when we talk about international, domestic, targeted violence, what do the numbers look like? You know, what does the threat look like? How does it change? And I think that responds to a lot of bills we've seen in Congress, both on the Republican and Democratic side. And then finally, I'd mention you know, it's on page 24, so I don't want people to miss it. But there is a talk about recidivism in this. I mean, you look at domestic terrorism, international terrorism, you know, the prison sentences are getting increasingly shorter, and the programs in order to reintegrate these individuals back in is increasingly small, too. And if terrorism is a form of crime, however abhorrent it is, you're going to see recidivism in any form of crime. And so they're going to have to wrap their head around that.
So sort of that's all, I think, incredibly helpful framing. And sort of picking up on Seamus's last comment and sort of for the first question for you, you know, this word targeted violence, to sort of key in a little bit on the definitional stuff here. So this document uses the term domestic terrorism, uses this word targeted violence. That second one, I think, is a little bit less familiar to people. I understand it's not a brand new term, but it is a little bit new in this context. And so, you know, let's drill down a little bit on what exactly are we talking about whenever you say targeted violence.
Sure. So it's not a new term, to your point. So DOJ has used it, Secret Service has used it for several years. So what we're talking about are acts of violence that are premeditated. So the venue or the place has been identified beforehand. I think the difference that we're talking about in differentiating targeted violence versus domestic terrorism is not tied to any one ideology. So it's individuals, again, mainly lone actors, but not always, are taking certain actions, some of which they leave manifestos, some they do not, that are targeting institutions in a way to make it look like a terrorist act. But again, I think the key that we focus on, again, at the department is it's not tied to any one ideology, is the key there. So when we look at domestic terrorism and we start looking at ethnic, racially motivated, anti-authority, anti-government, environmentalism, abortion, you know, you can go down the list of a lot of ideologies that are tied to specific domestic terrorist events, and you can do the same on the international terrorism side. So what differentiates from a departmental perspective on targeted violence is just that. And again, a lot of the manifestos and information that's left behind point to that as well.
So, George, you, in your opening comments, sort of touched on the surge and sort of number of essentially domestic threats we've seen, and that it actually outstrips sort of the foreign-inspired or foreign-connected threats in terms of actual impact here in the United States. You know, listening to this definition of targeted violence as being sort of untethered from ideology, does that reflect the actual threat that we're seeing? Is it sufficiently comprehensive? Is it over-inclusive? You know, how does it sort of match with the threat landscape as you understand it?
So I think that the way that it's laid out in this framework meets or comes to pace with where the numbers we've seen over the past 24 or 36 months for the nature and scope of threats, whether they be, to Jim's point earlier, whether they be on the far left of the ideological spectrum, on the far right, you know, of no ideological inspiration at all, that we can determine yet, like we saw in the Las Vegas country music concert shooting in the fall of 2017. And so I think the framework appropriately scopes that in a number of different ways. My contention would be that we've seen, and the security professionals and the analysts have seen, this evolution over the past decade, and we probably should have been at this point a bit sooner. Having said that, I'm pleased that the department is at this place now. I think the context and scope is absolutely appropriate for where we are today. And I sense from the Secretary's remarks and from how this document is laid out, there's enough flexibility to continue to adapt, whether there be ideological or other targeted violence evolutions happen over the next 24 to 36 months.
Can I just follow up on that? So I completely agree with what you just said, and I completely disagree with Seamus. But this is not going to transform the department in any other way, because this is basically a public safety responsibility that DHS is executing, and in the space that it's operating, you're not going to be able to tell much of a difference between whether this is the array of the things we just talked about or a targeted violence thing. So it doesn't really dramatically require them to do things dramatically different than they were doing before. That's why it's a strategic framework and not a strategy. It's just saying we're doing exactly what you said. We're organizing this mission for the long term to make a constructive contribution to national public safety, most of which in this particular area is actually going to be done by state and local governments. I mean, to the point the Department of Homeland Security gives out fire grants. They've been doing that since day one.
Yes.
It hasn't turned fire departments into national security instruments, and it hasn't dragged the department into running state and local fire departments. So the history of the department and how they've addressed it to the dual mission of being a homeland security agency primarily responsible for dealing with transnational terrorism and providing a bunch of national public safety functions, many of them in support and state and local governments. They've done that, and they haven't drifted and transformed. So I just think history is against you. I think you're wrong.
So I'll give Seamus an opportunity to stand up for himself if he wants to defend
but
the
do
sort
it
of proposition
yeah,
that
no.
this is that this really is a radical.
Yeah, no, Jim
completely
convinced me. how novel in D.C. No, I actually do think it changes. DHS is going to continue to do what DHS does. You know, when we set it up when I was in Congress, 20 years ago, it makes sense, but. But it does change in the actual implementation on some things. For example, the way you engage with tech companies on targeted violence is going to be different than the way you deal with ideologically motivated violence in terms of that. It's going to radically change the way you deal or want to address countering violent extremism issues. I mean, will we see whether this is just a word and kind of an expansion a little bit and whether this is just DHS moving on with the normal course of DHS? But if they did put down a marker, then you need to shift the way you approach it. And I think if you add the word targeted violence in there, you're putting down a marker.
Susan, can I make one last point on this? Sorry, one key point. General Allen made the point when asking the Secretary the question, what are the gaps and seams that exist? When we look at this issue in totality, whether it's the investigative lead of the Department of Justice and the FBI, their ability to prosecute, the core function of prevention, as it's built out within the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and other state and local law enforcement and Homeland Security entities across the United States, that is still a seam and a gap to some extent that continues to be filled. This framework is an attempt to fill that gap in the prevention space because of the nature of the threat today. And so as we think about this issue, understanding, as the Secretary pointed out, there's an action plan that assigns roles and responsibilities, et cetera. That's a key component to making sure that gaps and seams on prevention, irrespective of its targeted violence or ideologically motivated violence, is absolutely the next reasonable conclusion that departments should be taking. Sorry, Chad.
Yep. So I would agree and disagree with all my panelists.
Good work.
I would say, part of the strategic framework is to provide that leadership. And I think that's what the acting secretary is doing. I mean, we're here today talking about targeted violence, and what does that mean? We wouldn't have been up here 2 years ago talking about that. So I think there's a benefit to that. Second point, the acting secretary created the Office of Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention at the department, at the headquarters level, that helps, from an umbrella standpoint, pull together all the different pieces that the DHS and its components are doing, from CISA to service to INA and others, and making sure that we're all pushing forward, with one united front. So I think there's actually a lot of benefit when we talk about targeted violence, and there is difference in how the department is approaching this, not only through the terminology and the lexicon, but also through the prevention mission. So I think it's somewhere in between.
And Jim, I want to sort of push you on this idea or tease it out a little bit. So in your comments, you mentioned that DHS has been really, really successful and provided a lot of value in its mission sort of directed at transnational terrorism organizations and events. I think it's safe to say the government operates in a world of limited resources, and even if additional resourcing comes, we still have limited resources. So if the sustained focus on the sort of transnational elements has had real value and done real work, and the department is now also saying they're going to shift into this new space, and resources aren't going to magically increase, how do you square that? Are you saying that they can do it all at the same time?
Yeah, but this is the genius of the all-hazards approach, because the reality is the spaces that DHS are moving into are natural public safety support missions that they're already doing. So I agree that the value of kind of and this is one of the, as we struggled with the organization structure of the department over years and looked at reforms and everything else, the great challenge is how do you operationalize across these different entities and really bring effectiveness to all the things they can do? And again, I go back to the case of the Times Square bomber as, a tremendous example, which couldn't have happened in the old days, right? Pre-DHS, you could have never gotten that information about that, who that person is in real time, and get it to the guy at the airport in LaGuardia to nap, to get the guy, and then bring the FBI in. That just wouldn't have happened. And so the great challenge has really been synchronization across platforms to mimic capabilities, and I think that's exactly the point Chad gets to. What makes that happen? Leadership and focus and guidance. So I do think it's a question of leadership, focus, guidance, organization, not really a question of resources, because I really do think that's what the all-hazards vote says. We can't have a separate fire department for terrorists and earthquakes and fire departments and heart attacks and kittens up a tree. So we have one instrument which is capable of adequately supporting the needs of the community. And I do want to get into cyber at some point, so don't forget me.
All right. We will look back into it. And actually, this is a perfect segue because the question I planned to ask Seamus now was that another sort of element of this strategy is a note on the role of the internet in radicalization. You know, this is something you've written a lot about. You know, this is a document that specifically, if briefly, mentions places like 8chan and Gab.
Yep.
What is the role of DHS, you know, on these platforms, on more traditional social media platforms, sort of in addressing the threats that they're describing as emanating from these places?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the strategy, I think, rightly has three points. The first is to engage with tech partners on this issue. The second is to support counter-messaging by non-governmental organizations. And the third, I think, and to DHS credit, a call out to support the First Amendment and protections on that. Those are all very valid approaches. And in fact, we've had a history of the last 5 to 10 years of engagement with tech companies on these issues. My concern is as these organizations are going to be kicked off of more mainstream sites, the industry standards are going to be different. And so maybe 8chan doesn't want to take your phone call from the DNI or NCTC, right? And they have an incentive and a belief that, you know, free speech wins overall, right? As opposed to Google, Twitter, or Facebook, which got hammered by the Hill and then decided to pull back, right? And so this is going to be very different than it was in the next 5 years, especially as you go increasingly more niche sites like Telegram and 8chan.
Were you surprised to hear the acting secretary early in his comments with General Allen, I think I'm accurately characterizing, saying that he was commending Cloudflare on its decision to remove services, right? This is a controversial issue, sort of the notion of being able to deplatform these places through private actions. Should we understand that to be sort of a government endorsement of that? Is that an area in which we want to see the government taking action, or
yeah.
Or am I overreading his comment?
No, I don't think so. I mean, listen, every administration wants to put the finger on the scale every once in a while and not want, and then the lawyers tell you you can't, right? When it comes to this, it makes sense that they would call for that. And they're going to have to balance this, again, this third point, which is protect First Amendment, with isn't it great that Cloudflare put down the website? But the Obama administration did the same thing. You know, Jim Clapper flew to Silicon Valley and told them they should take down most ISIS propaganda, and wouldn't you know, that actually happened, right? And so every administration is going to do that. The question is whether it's a forcing function or you're just using the bully pulpit.
So before we sort of move to the cyber question that Jim wants to answer, Undersecretary Wolf, you know, this strategy document talks a lot about law enforcement partnerships in a little bit of a vague way. The unnamed or not frequently named partner party is the FBI.
Right.
And so I'm curious, you know, if you can sort of elaborate, what is the role of the partnership, and how does this strategic framework change what sort of the relationship between places like DHS and the FBI and DHS and state and local
sure.
governments?
Well, first of all, we have a very strong relationship with them, and I think the framework talks about a number of ways that we can improve that relationship and improve the information sharing. So whether we're talking about, our work with the social media companies and the larger platforms, DOJ and FBI are partners, as well as others in the interagency are partners in that discussion. DHS, to get back to the last question, DHS interacts with a lot of the social media companies, on a daily, weekly basis. And we do that a couple of different ways. We do that through the GIFCT, which is an industry group that I believe they're going to be making some announcements next week at UNGA to sort of formalize that group And we are certainly encouraging that and have been encouraging them to do that for some time. So we continue to talk with them about how to pull down content, terrorist-related content, quicker, faster. How do we provide off-ramps when appropriate? How do we do a number of other things, counter-messaging that the department's not really involved in, but the platforms are, along with NGOs and other private sectors. So we also, from a departmental standpoint, the department hosts a number of digital forums where we go into individual communities and we play sort of a collaboration between DHS, those tech companies that come into those communities, as well as local private NGOs that maybe not have that reach to a Facebook or to a Twitter or whoever. And we provide that link up, and they provide some solutions and start talking, and that dialogue continues. So that goes back to what we talk about as a community-based approach or a whole society approach. And so it's things like that where we can pull in the tech community and pull in the private sector that I think is really going to provide value over the next 2 to 3 years as we look at in the prevention space.
That teased you out, Jim, to make you know, the observations you went to about cyber.
A bit of a Debbie Downer here. Look, don't get too enamored in the rhetoric and the strategic framework about cyber, because the reality is DHS has virtually zero statutory authority over these agencies, over these private sector companies. They can't make them do anything, and they're not going to make them do anything, right? What DHS is going to do is, in some respects, what they've always done, which Chad just excellently described, is it's mostly an advisory role. They provide information and suggestions and best practices, and sometimes they use them effectively, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they actually tell DHS good stuff, and we use it effectively. So that's really business as usual, and the fact that they're bringing targeted violence into the discussion, that's all to the good. But honestly, that's business as usual. Where DHS is going to make a difference is in the dark web, which is really the most dangerous activity, because it's out of sight, and it's not just about radicalization, it's about where people can do things that are actually illegal and dangerous and get ready to kill people. And that's a space where DHS and FBI do have substantive authorities, and they can work effectively, and that is very effective on the preventative front. So that's the really good stuff. And just the last point to make is the center of gravity here is really the private sector actors, because we can all debate what the regulatory framework could be or should be or would be or whatever, and we'll debate that ad nauseum. But right now, the preponderance of authority of dealing with this really rests with the platforms themselves and what content they wish to host and not host. And what do we want out of a really good tech company? Well, we'd really like three things. One is, the one thing we love about the internet, it is that it is a public square of free ideas, right? It is the most powerful tool for free expression and to create, share, enliven, enrich ideas. And we'd hate to see that go away just because some Yahoo, you know, wants to get on there and say, you know, whatever. The other thing is it is one of the great engines of economic freedom, right? It has generated more wealth than anything. And we would hate to put strictures on that actually prevent people from getting on there and coming up with really cool ideas on how to make money. And the third thing is, you know, we would like a company that would actually not get our children killed, right? That they wouldn't get abducted by child rapists or whatever other bad things. And okay, so which of those are really important? And the answer is, we'd like all three. We'd like a company that is as free as possible. We'd love a company that just, we can make tons of money, and we'd like to be safe. And the answer is, striving to achieve all three has to be the goal of a good, responsible company. And the reality is, at the end of the day, despite whatever laws and everything else you want, they know more about their platforms than anybody else. Mm-hmm. They know their algorithms. They know their capabilities. They know how people exploit it. And I think the challenge for them is the challenge that I laid out before is, we have a political debate where people would like political outcomes, and they'd be happy to hijack public safety to get their political outcome. And then we've got the mission of actually keeping people safe and keeping his daughter from being abducted and keeping his grandmother from losing all her money to some guy in Nairobi, right? And they've got to navigate that and step up with that. And they've got to have good, honest discussions with our lawmakers in the framework. They have to have good discussions with Chad and his folks, because when they partner together in trust and confidence, and they actually do things that put all of us first, as opposed to focusing on political agendas, they actually accomplish some really good stuff.
Two quick points I would say. Sorry, George.
Go ahead.
Completely agree on the dark web, and there's a lot of great work that DHS is doing, and I could go on there.
I would say it's business as usual from an authority standpoint.
Right.
I agree with you.
Right.
I would not say it's business as usual as far as a leadership standpoint.
Fair point.
There's a number of things that the department's done over the last 2 years from really working with the social media companies that you see that are happening today that has laid the groundwork along with the interagency has laid the groundwork to get them to a certain place. Do we think they can do more? Absolutely. But I think I wouldn't characterize it as business as usual of, you know, it's what we've been doing day in and day out. So I do think there's been a lot of good work there. The authorities, yes. But I think the department will be the first one to stand up and say we need new authorities.
Right. I mean, some people respond and they say, oh, my God, DHS is going to tell, Twitter to take the blaze offline because terrorists like to read Twitter. And you're not going to do that. And you can't do that. That's my only point.
One addendum to the point that Jim and Chad made on the dark web. Christchurch, New Zealand, targeting Muslims. Poway targeting Jews, El Paso targeting Hispanic and Latinx immigrants, not the use of the dark web for planning, operation, or coordination,
right.
8chan, a publicly available browser and webpage that we can all go to. It's actually not up today, but there is, in fact, problems on the dark
absolutely.
Web, but the open web, too, has a lot of stuff we should talk about.
Fair enough.
So Jib said that he was going to be a downer. George, I want to give you the opportunity to be a downer as well. What we're describing here is an incredibly complex problem. Everybody on this stage has noted sort of strengths and weaknesses. What's missing from this document? Whenever we actually think about what the threat looks like and what changes are going to be needed to meet it, what do you not see in here?
What's missing is what the Secretary and Chad have alluded to in terms of the next steps. The next steps are the action plan for how are we going to take these priority actions that are carefully laid out throughout the document and how are we going to execute those. And related, what's our M&E? What's our measurement and evaluation for knowing that we're doing a good job and who in the department is accountable for driving that every single day and holding all the pieces and parts of this large organization accountable? And second, the associated funding. The Secretary alluded to the fact that there was an off-cycle request for additional resources. And so as we see the framework and we can evaluate the merits of is this the right layout and organization and construction, and then we get into the execution of it and associated resources, those two pieces are critical to knowing that if the document we're looking at today can be ultimately successful in the measurement, as he alluded to, in 12, 24, 36 months.
So, Seamus, there's been formally a CVE program at DHS for a long time using sort of some of the language we've seen here of sort of ideologically neutral or ideologically inclusive language. One critique of that program from the Obama administration on has been that was the terminology being used. The reality was that those efforts were actually only being focused on one form of violent extremism, namely sort of Islamic extremism. Why shouldn't someone look at a document like this and say, this is more elaborate window dressing, it's sort of more going down the terminology, but we're going to see the same thing we've seen in prior administrations who've tried to sort of put their arms around this problem. Do you think this is something different, or how would you sort of respond to someone who would launch that type of critique?
No, I think ask me again in 6 months. When you look at if the action plan comes out and gives the Office of Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention the lead in a number of areas, if the allocation of resources on the Hill asks for a plus up on countering violent extremism grants, which are said to be zeroed out, all of those things, right, that'll be the determining factor. We've seen both the Obama administration and the Trump administration a shrinking of personnel and resources towards this. And so if they're going to be serious about terrorism prevention, they're going to have to plus up.
I'll continue asking questions, but just sort of a last call for anyone who has note card questions to write those down and share it to the end, and we'll take time at the end to talk about it.
While we're writing cards, can I just come up a CV comment? I thought the problem with CV programs is they're wildly ineffective. And it wasn't that they were targeted on one group. It's that oftentimes the department was partnering with people which were actually fomenting extremism. So they were really crappy often about picking their partners. And I think there's a real question of the efficacy of the whole idea. And I thought it was a horrible place for the department to work. I think the department should get out of the ideology business. They're not well suited to that. They're a law enforcement agency. And I thought what the strategic framework describes about where the FBI and DHS partner great is their law enforcement agencies and those activities. And when they partner on the prevention and the response and the precursor activities themselves, that's a sweet space where they work very effectively. But broadly, having DHS kind of combat bad ideas is just a bad idea.
So as the person who ran that office and oversaw that grant program, I totally disagree. But Jim and I can have coffee afterwards, and I can make my case to him.
So we've mentioned resourcing and the importance of resourcing to take this from a strategic vision to an actual reality. What do those resources look like? You know, does DHS have what it needs? Is it able to get what it needs? You know, or is this all just sort of a nice idea and some leadership values, but a long way off from actually getting what you need to?
And the acting secretary, sort of touched on it briefly. I don't think DHS is where it needs to be from a resource standpoint to really address the threat and everything that we've talked about today. I would say a couple of things. One, he's directed a number of actions to occur today. So without increasing resources or funding. All the folks from DHS that are in the audience, Secret Service, CISA, CRCL, and others are surging resources today. So we're just doing that sort of out of hide. That's not sustainable in the long term. So as he mentioned, he requested an out-of-cycle budget request for FY20. I can tell you that the department's leaning in on the FY21 request, currently working with OMB and others on that. So we hopefully that will turn out. But yes, that you will see more resources dedicated, at least from a DHS perspective, on the prevention side, as well as some of the other topics that we've touched on.
For you or for anyone on the panel, is it just a money problem, or is there also a need for new legislation, for new authorities, resources?
I'm going to pass on that one, but I'll let these guys.
I would argue, Jim may disagree, that that a little the nature of what we're talking about here is in some ways is a paradigm shift. It's not kind of the post 9/11 world as we know it. The world has changed. I mean, and the strategy alludes to this. The communications infrastructure, the speed and nature and scope of radicalization and mobilization is different today. And when you see 4chan, 8chan, Gab, when you see vitriolic, bigoted rhetoric packaged neatly next to bomb-making instructions on the open web, this is a threat environment that didn't exist a decade ago, per se. And it's changed, and it's a lot faster, and coupled with the nature of a hyper-polarized environment politically, it's a very combustible mix. And so the position that we're in today with the speed and rate of information packaged with this concept that many white supremacists refer to as accelerationism, like I need to do something today. I need to go into the synagogue. I need to walk into this Walmart and execute the threat against a white majority in this country. That's a very lethal combination that we see playing out. And so positioning, whether it's the federal government or state and local and community officials, to address that is, I think, one of the paramount challenges that we will face for the years to come.
So I'll mention an area, and I think the secretary mentioned, Chad, you might have mentioned it too, which is the adversarial use of drones domestically as a threat. We just had this situation with an attack on Saudi Arabia, a combination of 17 cruise missiles and drones, and a significant elevation and kind of the of what you can do with drones and payloads, and that technology is proliferating rapidly. It's available domestically, and we're not there yet in terms of what because largely this is a state and local problem, because we're not going to see drones with 1,000-mile ranges where you're going to launch a drone from Utah, and we're going to hit the Capitol with it. We're going to see things that happen probably within the scope of 50, 100, couple of miles. And so it's largely going to be in the area of state and local governments. But a lot of that airspace is actually owned by FAA. And there are some regulatory issues there. We do have to kind of have a management system there. And at some point we have to empower state and local governments on how they can protect large venues and communities and everything else. And the private sector is going to bring on defensive technologies, and you don't want a defensive technology that jams and brings down the drone and also jams the entire emergency response network or the fire department, right? So there's a lot of stuff to be unpacked. And I am a little worried that I know we're working on it. I'm just a little worried that the other guys are going to work on it faster.
So there is a little bit of an elephant in the room anytime you're talking about a preventive law enforcement mission with a domestic focus that has an ideological element to it, right? Whether, even though it encompasses many ideologies, and that elephant in the room is the First Amendment. One of the reasons why it's been difficult for the FBI and other law enforcement to be fully effective in this space is because there's not material support laws that sort of provide criminal predicate at an earlier stage. Should we be concerned about overreach here as we start to hear agencies like DHS that are focused on prevention, that are getting involved earlier in the cycle, focusing on these issues, focusing on what people are saying? Does that give anybody here sort of heartburn, or is that where the threat is, and so that's where we need to see DHS go?
Well, do remember, most of this is really going to fall on the shoulders of the private sector and state and local governments, and they're the ones that are going to have to deal with the legal issues, the liability, the issues of freedom of speech issues. In some sense, it's like not DHS's problem, right? But you're right, is people have to be very thoughtful, not just how they work in this space, but how they communicate what they do in this space. Because there are people on both sides that are terribly sensitive, right? There are conservatives, for example, who would say, anytime you mention this thing, what you're trying to do is to try, link me to some skinhead white supremacist. And that scares me. And on the other side, there are people that think, for example, every time you don't emphasize this, it means you don't really care about my synagogue and everybody in there is going to die, right? And so it is both a public affairs, public speaking challenge for state and local and private sector, and a very significant management challenge as well.
So,
I'll just continue, and then George.
Okay. Obviously, this is a difficult issue for the department, and it's why we are very specific when we talk about the issue and identifying folks that are radicalizing to violence.
Right.
So, radicalization and on the internet and doing what you want to. That's not what we're focused on. It's the violence part that we are extremely focused on. It's also what you'll see in the strategic framework time and time again is a community-based or whole society approach. So a lot of what we do is providing resources, training, people, and intelligence at times to those local communities. Those are the individuals. Those are the groups that are going to see folks that perhaps are prone to radicalization, to violence first. It's not going to be DHS officials out in the field. There's never going to be enough of that. So a lot of what we do from a departmental perspective is different from what DOJ does. They prosecute, they investigate, they do that. We're more, again, on the preventative side. We have some protection activities as well, but more on the preventative side and working with the local folks to do that.
Making Homeland Security policy that's data-informed and data-driven is critical.
Right.
Two pieces of legislation to call out, Susan, to answer your question. The Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, I think, helps us get closer to making policy that's data-informed and data-driven, as well as the Data Act, another element to get a more wide spread accounting of hate crimes and bias-motivated crimes. Currently, there are dozens of cities across the country with populations of 100,000 people or more that affirmatively report zero hate crimes or bias-motivated crimes in their communities. So as we think about really assessing this, In coupling with an annual threat assessment coming out of DHS, those two pieces of legislation help get us to better informed data-driven policy.
I would, the short answer for your question is yes. Listen, I know what international terrorism is. I know what domestic terrorism is. I know what targeted violence is because I read a 1995 report, right? But it's not a lexicon in DHS, right? It's an understanding maybe in HHS and things like that. So if you introduce a new term of art in there, you're going to have overreach in some nature as people try to figure out what the right and left latitudes are of that. So yes, it should be a concern.
Can I just, it's not strictly a quantitative problem. I mean, go back to your original statement. More people die from domestic terrorism than foreign terrorism, right? Which is interesting, but belies the point that what the foreign terrorists are trying to do is far more expansive and have in scope maybe more capabilities. And the reason why the foreign terrorists maybe has gone down is actually because the department's actually doing a really good job. And that's perhaps why domestic terrorism seems like more significant. So I don't see it as, I don't disagree with you. I completely agree with you. We ought to have data, and it ought to be data informed. But the department's in the business of risk. Risk is threat, vulnerability, and criticality, right? And that's not a strictly quantitative measure. And so they have to think about what's the best to protect the nation as a whole. I want to applaud the department, and Seamus is exactly right. Good for you for doing a national threat assessment, right? Because they tried doing a national risk assessment, which was the stupidest activity any human being could think of, because you cannot measure national risk, right? Because you can't define vulnerability in a way that really, really makes sense. I mean, so you can't. You can write a report and say this is a national risk assessment, but it's a lie because you really can't pull all that stuff together in a way that's competent. But you can define threats in a way that makes sense and touch on the quantitative issues, which ought to be data-driven, but also looking at the intent of the adversaries, what their goals are, and that's a much more reasonable and achievable project, and I applaud the department for doing that.
Great.
So we'll turn to questions, and if anybody has them and wants to pass them to the end, please do so now. So this question is, in the internet age, if you censor one platform, another will pop up. Government-sanctioned or forced censorship seems like an un-American and ineffective action. Is this view addressed in this strategy planning?
We certainly touch on, obviously, the role that social media platforms and the tech community writ large. As been mentioned on stage here, it's not DHS's, you know, role alone to police the internet. That's not what we do. DOJ, FBI, and others certainly have a role when they talk about investigating any type of companies, to include the tech companies. So that's not really what the department's doing. We're certainly much more in a partnership with these tech companies to talk about how they're, again, able to pull down content. We're not looking to censor or regulate at this time, but how do they pull down the content? How do they provide the offering? Are they doing enough? And I think what we have seen over the particularly the past 2 years, if you go back 2 years, I think there was a, I think the consensus in government was that not nearly enough is being done in this space. We're not seeing a collaborative approach, and we want to see more. And I think over the past couple of years, we've seen that. We want to continue to work with them. We think more can be done. And as I indicated earlier, I think, you know, the announcement next week, I think, is a step in the right direction, and we hope to see more along those lines.
I would also say, I mean, despite my boyish good looks, I'm not a huge believer in the idea of internet radicalization, right? Of course these guys are online because the average age is 28, and so they're online, but they're online next to their best friend in the same room watching Anwar Al-Awlaki videos. And so if you look at the, if you pull down the cases, it's really also an in-person network. I mean, there's a reason why 5,000 folks left from Europe and only 250 left from the U.S. to go join the Islamic State. It's because there was an in-person network that worked out. And so I think we sometimes focus on the online environment because it's the right. most overt manifestation of the threat. And it's, frankly, if I'm a congressional staffer, it's the easiest thing to do. You know, tech companies, you take care of this problem, as opposed to right. DHS, here's new grants, money, measures of effectiveness, and this is how you're going to do countervailing extremism programs. That is all hard and political and things like that, where it's an easy win to go to tech companies and say, just, you know, take down the internet.
Seamus' point is really important. It shouldn't be missed.
All right.
Really. There are, you know, give me another good example is India, right, where there's massive, you know, and very, very little radicalization. And because, you know, people look at the mass of the content and then they say, oh, that's the problem. But what we've seen over and over and over again, where a social network is influenced is where it's connected to a human network underneath that. If there's no human network underneath that, you know, occasionally you'll get a Christchurch or some other Yahoo, but you're not going to see that organized campaign of violence, and that's the real danger. And so I think sometimes we make a big mistake if we focus on this and we ignore that, because if there's no human work, most of that social stuff's not really going to accomplish anything. I just want to make one quick point to say what Chad said in just, you know, very blunt terms. They can't censor anybody. They don't have the regulatory to do that, right? And I think one of the things we have to be really sensitive from is there are groups on the right and the left who are concerned that this is going to evolve into censoring political free speech and marginalizing their ability to express themselves. And I think that's why I think it's incredibly important that we be very precise and clear that that whatever you're doing is not a threat to that, because they're going to believe that. And even when you tell them clearly that it's not, they're still going to believe that. And so we just have to be very, very careful about what we say we're actually doing here. Because and you cannot go to people and say your concerns aren't legitimate, because there are conservatives that have been kicked off networks and they do feel like they're being censored. And just telling them, no, you're just a Yahoo, that doesn't really make them feel any better.
So the next question is, can you elaborate on the framework's approach to emerging technology issues, particularly unmanned aerial systems?
Sure. The strategic framework does touch on UAS and how we counter UAS. We have a program office in the policy office that's help coordinating the authorities that the Congress so aptly gave the department, I believe, last year to counter the UAS threat. It is a threat. We see it in a variety of different environments. both from the border, but also elsewhere. Secret Service and others have been involved in the threat and how to counter the threat for some time. So we see it manifesting, and we certainly see it as an emerging risk, both an emerging technology, and how do we address that? So DHS has some very limited authority. So I think part of what we talk about when we talk about UAS is trying to level set where the department is and what we can and can't do. Aside from the service, who has discrete authorities, you know, the department has some very, I would say, limited authorities that we are undertaking as it relates to DHS-covered facilities and assets, but as well as some of sort of the mass gatherings that we look at. So the strategic framework certainly touches on that. That's a big component as we look ahead down the line of where do we need to put our resources. And we talked about budgeting and resourcing, and as we look ahead to FY20 is kind of past us from a budgeting standpoint, but as we look ahead to 2021 and 22 and beyond, how we bolster the department's CUAS capabilities is part of that conversation.
Does anyone else have thoughts on that part of the framework? So sort of, we're getting close to the end of time here. You know, this is not, it's a new focus, but it's not an entirely new thing for a big federal agency to shift its focus and to add something else into its mission and to unveil big strategic frameworks. And we've done it in the past. What are the lessons learned, particularly as we look sort of on DHS's track record over the, you know, with respect to the transnational terrorism threat? You know, what are the things that as you shift your focus to this domestic set of issues, you know, mistakes, lessons learned, what are you taking from that? Or should be?
I'll start having run one of the offices that was doing this work early on at DHS. And to Jim's point, even though I disagree with his premise that this was a bad idea, it was flawed from the get-go, that tells me that the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, can do a better job of explaining what it does, why it does it, and how it came to those conclusions. There's room for the federal government writ large, DHS specifically, to improve the way that it provides transparency to the American public, that it engages with its citizens, that we kind of roll out different programs and initiatives. There's always room to do that better. Some of those lessons I learned the hard way, as Jim rightfully points out, and I think the department is taking some steps in this framework to make its framework, to make the appropriate priority areas more public, more engaging. And my hope is that conversations like this happen in cities and states across the country with a diverse set of local leaders who can engage in thoughtful conversations about how to apply and how to engage with the department.
You know, I think you have to stay in your core competencies and stay focused on the mission. Because the reality is as somebody who really is happy to say, oh my God, this is so awesome, they're dealing with targeted violence. Tomorrow, some city will sink beneath a hurricane and the department will be excoriated because they were focused on targeted violence and they ignored the hurricane, right? Or we're going to be focused on targeted violence and tomorrow there'll be a 9/11 and the first article that's going to be written is, well, that's because Department of Homeland Security was asleep at the switch. They were focused on worried about some skinhead and they were ignoring Al-Qaeda and that's why we all died, right? So you cannot win that fight. They cannot win that fight. All they can do is do their job within their core competencies and focus on the mission. But your point's exactly right, and that was the point I was trying to make too, is we'd be an idiot to recognize that this isn't surrounded by politics, and the department has an extra obligation to speak with clarity yes. and consistency, often, even when people aren't listening, trying to explain, we are doing a risk-informed public safety mission to the best of our ability with the people that we have, even as people yell at them that you're just a bunch of, you know, you're running concentration camps or whatever. That's all they can really, really do. And I do kind of applaud them for, you know, trying to on this effort, at least initially, try to kind of explain that and lay that out. So good for them. But it's a tough job.
I would say I think this framework marries up well with the White House's national counterterrorism strategy. And I think, understandably so, given where the NSC process is, that DHS in some ways got out in front of an implementation plan for the national CT strategy. And I think in many ways laid down a marker. And so in order for this policy to be effective, there's going to have to be an interagency process for this because the fact that DHS does CT work that in many ways marries up with FBI and DOJ, they're going to need them to sign off. Mm-hmm. And the only way you sign off is a national kind of White House implementation plan. And so I applaud DHS for getting out in front and saying this is what we're going to do, but the rest of the interagency is going to have to fall in line.
So I would say we're engaged in those conversations with the interagency, so I would agree with that. I would also agree with James's point that the department has a PhD in criticism, so I appreciate that. We deal with that every day. For back to your question, though, what's changed or what are the markers? I think the proof is in the pudding. So as I think maybe Seamus mentioned, in 6 months from now, what does this look like? And what has the department done? And how has it positioned itself? But I do want to caution when we talk about resources and we talk about, what more can the department do, that's not going to show up overnight. That's not going to even show up perhaps in 6 months from now. So we're a budget cycle off and a fiscal year off, so that's going to have to catch up unless something dramatic happens. I will say one of the lessons learned is, early on we pulled in, particularly because of the nature of the topic we're talking about, when we talk about First Amendment, we talk about domestic terrorism, pulling in our experts at the department on privacy and CRCL, I think was critical in understanding the concerns that they hear from their communities, respective communities, and building that into the framework. And that was something that the acting secretary made a priority. So we did that early on. I don't know that the department's always been best at that, but that is reflected in this document as well.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.